I heard you speaking before, and you talked about how there's a lot of parallels in the various religions.
Yes.
To the, you know, the Anunnaki stories.
Yes, there's a flood story in almost every religion around the world, no matter where you go. Even people who don't have religions, who just have stories, there's a parallel in the flood story. Kingship. One of the things that was given to mankind was how you rule each other. And kingship was the Anunnaki's form of government. They had kings. So yes. they gave us that. And the interesting thing about that is that it still exists in some of the Hawaiian history, is that the way they had the top purebred leader was that you married your sister. The king had to marry his sister. And the product of that, of course, was a pure bloodline. And that's what Enlil is. In other words, in the story in my book, the two main characters from the Anunnaki are Enlil, the purebred from the sister and the father, and Enki, who was born from a concubine. Although Enki was the firstborn son, he didn't get to be the king. He wasn't in line for succession to the king because his mother wasn't his father's sister.
Yeah.
So that kind of goes to the history. And if you look at the current garb of the terrorists that we're dealing with in the eastern part of the world, the Islamic, and you look at the cylinder seals of the Anunnaki, how they dressed, it's exactly the same.
Oh, really?
They're trying to flip back to the founders.
Now, how do you think the various world religions are affected by this hypothesis? Like, do you think can they coexist with this? Can they adopt it into their belief structure?
Yes. I would hope. My hope is that once they realize that we all came from the same place and that we splintered throughout history and created different forms of religion, but the origin of all the major religions in the world is the same. And what my hope is, you know, unfortunately, majority of the slaughter that has gone on in the name of my God's the right God since civilization began has been horrendous. And if we could put a stop to religious warfare, when people understand that they're all the same, that they all came from the same heritage, that the Anunnaki were our creators, and that the prophets, or whatever you want to call the others who they revere and worship, came from the same place. We might eventually, it's going to take quite a while, get rid of religious warfare, I would hope. That's goal number one. The second thing is that if you look at our genetic makeup, here's one of the things that you can do. You look at the human genome study that was done in 2001.
Yeah.
Again, humans are about 25,000 plus or minus genes.
Yeah.
But there's 223 genes in our profile that aren't accounted for. They have no history. They have no predecessors. And the people who did the survey are trying to figure out, well, where the hell these genes come from. Well, they came from the Anunnaki. We all have that. Every one of us on this planet are genetically connected to this lineage.
Now, touching on the religious aspect of it, now, I know a lot of this ties in with the Old Testament, and I'm sure a lot of this is probably speculation on your part here, but I'm sure you thought about how does Jesus, the religious figure, fit into all this? Do you have an opinion on what, when you strip it from the, when you strip the, you know, the religious story off, looking at it from the perspective we are, where do you think Jesus fits into this?
Well, I can give you an answer, and I will in a minute, but I want you to remember the history of the three major religions. Abraham was one of the chosen leaders that the Anunnaki selected to work for them, be a military man. His firstborn son was Ishmael, who was born from Hagar, which was Sarah's, Abraham's wife's servant. She was an Arab. So Ishmael was the firstborn son of Abraham, and then Isaac, after the covenant was made, became the firstborn son of Sarah and Abraham. So here we have Judaism, Christianity, and Islam from the same person, Abraham. Now, Jesus was Jewish. Jesus was born from Mary and a father, and he preached a form of Judaism that was very much similar to what we see today in the Old Testament. The Anunnaki were revered by the Sumerians as lords. And they, and one of the reasons that the intermarriage thing happened was that some of the Anunnaki lords coveted females of mankind and produced offspring who were giants. And this kind of goes back to the history of the Bible somewhat, but also you had human females producing strong giants. In the Battle of Troy, you have the fight between Hector and Achilles. And Achilles' mother said that Achilles' father was Zeus. Zeus was an Anunnaki. So the son of a leader, Jesus was the son of God. And at that time, in the Jewish religion, they always predicted a Messiah as part of the religion, and their God was Yahweh. And if Jesus was the son of Yahweh, I'm not saying that I can prove this or that it's true at all, but I'm saying that this has happened before in history, that leaders have been produced by genetic intermarriage of humans and the Anunnaki. That's not unheard of before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what happened, a new religion was born. It was based on Judaism, but it grew and became the official religion of the Romans around 300 A.D., and up till then, the Romans worshipped the same 12 gods and with different names that the Sumerians did. You know, if you look through history of the characters of the leaders, I'll give you an example. Enki was a water god. His brother was the leader, Enlil. Okay, we go start with the Romans. Romans had Jupiter and his brother Neptune. Neptune was the water god. In the Greeks, we had Zeus and Poseidon were brothers and leaders. So here, you know, these are the same identities down through 6,000 years of time where humanity worshipped these 12 leaders until Christ came along. And when Christ became the leader of Christianity, you know, up to that time, the only other religion with a single deity was the Jewish religion.
Now, what do you think caused the change from the polytheistic to the monotheistic? Do you think that was by design, or was that just a cultural change?
I don't know. I mean, it happened. I mean, we just got to accept it.
Oh, yeah. No, I just didn't know if you know.
You know, and all of a sudden, these 6,000 years of revering these 12 leaders in various forms, they become pagans.
Yeah, it's a very interesting change.
Yeah, it's you know, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world.
Yeah,
is the Temple of Zeus in Greece. It was a statue of 75-foot tall Homo sapien clad in gold.
Wow.
And he was Zeus, but he was a Homo sapien. I mean, he looked like us. So what I'm saying is that we look like them, and we are part of them. They look, you know, they were depicted by whoever did them, saw them as Homo sapiens.
Now, so if Jesus was created by ET progenitors or extraterrestrials, theoretically, then that would mean that they had to have come back, because there was quite a distance between when they first created us and when they created him. So that,
yes.
That's a,
yes.
Do you have an opinion on why that would happen? At least a theory.
No, I don't. And I would say, you know, 600 years later, like 600 A.D., we have Muhammad dealing with Allah.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's, to me, another story, and I can't tell you.
Yeah, so perhaps there was an agenda there to change something in the control mechanism. Just with the
Well, bear in mind, you've hit on something there, Tim, that throughout the history of my reading about through the translations of the two clans, the Enki clan and the Enlil clan, is that they were rivals for power.
Ah.
And they had a rivalry that existed, you know, for thousands of years.
So it stands to reason that there would be factions vying to change the belief structure of the race of people.
Absolutely. I'll give you a classic example. Sitchin refers to the atomic war of 2000-something B.C. And the evidence is Sodom and Gomorrah, and the fact that the Sumerian civilization was wiped out in a fashion of Hiroshima, if you read the story of how the evil wind left the desert of the Sinai and went north and east, and, you know, the atomic fallout and just wiped everybody out. And they made a mistake. You know, here are some highly advanced people who have atomic weapons who should have known not to use them. They should have known about the fallout, and they destroyed the thing that they built, the thing that they were most proud of, which was the Sumerian civilization. They wiped it out. And at the end of my book, I describe the dialogue as given to us by Sitchin's The Lost Book of Enki, of how they dealt with it. And it's fascinating to, imagine this horrible thing happening. Because they were warring, it was actually their offspring, their children, their grandchildren that caused the war, part of the clan. And it was all a battle over territory and power. Territory and power. They used us, you know, after we became the primitive workers, we became soldiers in armies. And do you remember Homer's, the Iliad?
Yes, yes.
Okay, and then if you read what this guy was saying about an event that took place, which was the Trojan War, he talks about the gods and how the gods were actually playing in the background, pulling strings to cause this to happen.
Huh.
That they dazzled, what's his name, with Helen and got him to go get Helen, bring her just so they'd have a war.
Huh.
Now, Homer's saying, you know, everybody thought that story was kind of a myth. All of a sudden, they dug around in the part of the earth there, and they found Troy. They found 9 levels of Troy. They didn't find the Trojan horse, but they found pottery, Tim, with the pictures of the horse on it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, to me, I'm saying if Homer said that this happened, and everybody thought it was a myth, and all of a sudden we've dug around and found some evidence of it, what's to say that what he said about the gods wasn't also true?
Exactly.
So, there's all kinds of interesting angles to the story and why we are the way we are today, I think, is because we were genetically engineered to be not as powerful as they are. But here's another thing for you, Tim. I just thought of this. They're space travelers. They came here and they had to do all kinds of huge mathematical calculations to get from A to B. we could not have landed on the moon or even started our space age without mathematical capability to figure out how to do that. And if we were just the product of evolution, I don't see anything in evolution that would have given us mathematical ability. There's no need for it.
Yeah.
So we must have got it genetically. We must have gotten this ability. And it's increasing because we're researching and we're discovering, and our brains are able to comprehend, you know, the angle of impact when you come back into the atmosphere so that you don't burn up. Very important when our shuttle comes back.
Mm-hmm.
That all that calculation, those computers and everything work so that we don't burn up. We have to hit the right angle, and that's math. And we didn't get math, I don't think, except by inheriting it from our gene code.
From the Sumerians, they accepted and acknowledged that their gods were from off the earth.
Oh, yeah.
And obviously today that's a non-discussed concept except for in our circles of the
esoteric
research.
Right, exactly.
Now, where along the line do you think that transition happened? At some point, it became hidden. And do you think? Well, let's just go with that first, and then I'll go with the next question.
In the story of Gilgamesh. One of the things I point out, there's five things that the story told us, but one of the things it told us in the beginning was that there was an interface between the Anunnaki and the people of Uruk, because they were in trouble and they asked for help. And what they got from the Anunnaki was Enkidu. Now, the second thing was that Ishtar, we have a statue of Ishtar, it was found in ruins. And she's a 4,000-year-old replication of a person with a helmet that enabled her to go off the planet and up into the orbiting spaceship and back. In fact, the story of Gilgamesh tells about her travels back and forth. So here we're being told that that can happen. And the weapon that she comes back with is... pretty powerful. It's called the Bull of Heaven. And, that's kind of an indication that when she got really mad, she had the bull blow trench holes in Uruk, in 200-foot holes in the ground, which people died into. So, I mean, there are indications of what they were capable of, and they're in the stories that were left to us. And I think it's important to look at it perhaps this way, Jim. If 100,000 years from now we take off to a new home we found someplace, and we look at everything looks great except there's something wrong, we don't want it, we're going to find something else, but there is a bunch of humanoids running around there, and they're pretty backward, and they've got all kinds of trouble. So, why don't we help them? And the way we help them is we get their leader and we give them 10 rules to live by.
Yeah.
And that's very possible that we would do that. And that's called a transfer of technology or information that would be helpful to them. And, the story in the Bible of Moses and the Ten Commandments could be looked at in that fashion.
Do you think this was a human decision to keep the fact that the gods were extraterrestrials from the general public, or was that an Anunnaki decision, or do you think that it was just that they couldn't quite understand the concept of a being living on another planet and coming here?
Well, okay.
You follow what I mean?
I know what you're saying, and the only thing that comes to my mind is Galileo. Our understanding of what's going on, like only 396 years ago, Tim, we were the center of the universe, and the sun revolved around us.
Yeah.
That was the story being told to us by the authorities, the church. And Galileo looked up through his little telescope and said, no, that's not true. We're not the center of the universe. We're just one little planet that goes around that star, that sun. And there's a huge thing out there. And guess what he got for his information telling? House arrest for the rest of his life. He was by, it was by the Inquisition, by the way. The Inquisition said, you know, you want to recant what you said? And he said, no, I won't recant it. And he says, you know, Copernicus was right. This is, I'm a mathematician. This is what's going on out there. And they said, okay, bang, in the slammer, into your house, you don't come out again. So the suppression by the authorities, at that time the authorities was the Roman Catholic Church, which were scientists. They had scientists that were studying things, but this didn't quite fit what they wanted it to be at that time. So that's the story that we lived with until, you know, all of a sudden we discovered Galileo was right. We got this problem, and whether they anticipated that, whether the Anunnaki would anticipate that that's what happened, I don't know. Certainly, the evidence that we have is all we can look at.
Yeah.
What they did and what they left and what they gave us.
Moving on to the present-day UFO phenomenon, I'm sure you know some about that.
So sure.
I just wanted to ask you, a lot of people I talk to, they're all about disclosure. I'm sure you know about that, disclosure.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Their point of view is they want disclosure of the present UFO phenomenon.
Absolutely. You know?
And obviously you want disclosure of your hypothesis.
Yes.
So what do you think, which one could come first? What do you think is the best way to go about disclosure? Would it be easier to tell the people first that the extraterrestrials were coming here, or perhaps first tell them about the your theory and decision theory of the ET progenitors, and then sort of lead them to, you know, and they may come back or something like that?
Well, yes, I would say that the story needs to be gotten out. Both stories need to be gotten out, and the fear that apparently exists, that the public couldn't handle it. Now, that's been around for a long time, but I don't think that's the reason, the real reason, that scientists want to prove things. The scientific method is to prove that you can replicate something over and over again, and therefore it's true. And, you know, they're finding that there's holes in the evolution theory right now. They can't prove where the DNA came from and how it should be made. That's kind of a, you know, where did the seeds of DNA come from? There's all kinds of phenomena. I think that the people seem to believe the scientific community, Jim.
Yeah.
In other words, we're again being led by those who think they know everything, and they don't.
Exactly.
They're, you know, I'm reading about the string theories coming apart, and that Hawking's black hole theory, he's not sure anymore that that's true. And I'm seeing evidence in the scientific community that they're getting a bit flustered about what they're trying to do. Our story, the story that you've pursued and I'm pursuing, I think is a story that will eventually be accepted. It has to be accepted because it's true. And the proof of it is by all the things that are here that are, you know, pointed out in my book. And if people would just, you know, take the time to look at some of the pictures and figure out that that we couldn't do those things, then by deduction, it has to mean that somebody else did.
Mm-hmm.
And that somebody else has to be the people that they talk about in the tablets, because the tablets are a recorded history of what went on, albeit written by the winners, you know.
Exactly, yes.
Come out the way they wanted to, in the apologies that they did. But our story is solid, Tim. I mean, I wrote the book because I needed to prove to myself that this was a true story.
Yeah.
Sitchin kind of gave me the framework to deal with, but I said, no, all right, how do I prove that? And everything that I've put in the book are things that I believe prove irrefutably that this story's true. And I hope people would take the time to look at the book or buy it or whatever they want to do to get the information and pass it on, because you can show your friends these pictures, and they're going to get astounded.
Exactly, yes. That's for sure. I can attest to that.
And the other part of it, you know, the UFO phenomenon, which is certainly out there, is part of it. It's part of the story, and it just needs to be given legitimacy. You know, and it's, you know, to me, the thing that I was really ticked off about in Timothy Ferris's movie that I told you about, Life Beyond Earth,
yeah,
is that these great scientists he brings together in this flick all say there's life out there. It's got to be. But not one of them was willing to put forward the fact that they'd already come here, that contact was made 450,000 years ago. And then we're the product. I mean, if you want evidence more than other than the sound things, look at us. Where'd we come from?
Yeah.
Now, we're so unique, Tim. Our species is unlike any species on this planet. And if you think that Homo erectus took 1,800,000 years to evolve to his state, which was he couldn't talk, and he hit two stones together for his tools. In 250,000 years, when we, from the time our first skeletal remains are found in Africa at the gold mines where they said they did it, we're walking on the moon. Now, how does a species go in the short time of 250,000 years to do this? It just has to be another explanation other than evolution.
And do you think a generational change will help usher this line of thought into mainstream?
However long it takes, Tim, it'll happen. And by the way, I'm not the only one that's involved in this. It's a dialogue that's been going on now for a long time, and it'll continue to go on, and people will add to it, and there'll be more things written about it, and eventually it'll surface up to the level of national attention, where it deserves to be examined. And I think the school thing might be the wedge that we could use to get the thing into the mix, because many, many school boards are wondering how they're going to resolve this issue, what they're going to teach our children. And if our children are not taught the truth, and not taught all the facts, then we're going to have problems.
Exactly. So this is sort of an this way of thinking actually bridges the two sides.
Yeah, it brings them together, actually, because each is half right. And the genetic engineering theory encompasses both, because we did come from a species that was evolving, the Homo erectus. It's a creature. And we appeared because we were made the way we were made by, in the image of our Creator. I mean, they say it in the Bible.
So what it'll really take is a brave person to stand up and say, hey, this is, we need to consider this.
Yes,
this
is the... absolutely, Tim. If you can find anybody at MIT there, it would be great.
I'll see what I can do.
Okay.
Now, you've been in contact with Sitchin, I understand, right?
Yes, I'm in contact with him all the time.
What's the extent of your work with him? Just correspondence, pretty much?
Yes, it's very interesting. He's a charming gentleman who lives in an age without a computer. He has no email. I write him letters. I talk to him on a telephone. And he's still typing on a Hunt and Peck typewriter.
No kidding.
Yeah, no, the letters. I can show you one day the letters I got from him. And I really feel, you know, part of my, I'm on another mission besides getting this story out. I want to get him a Nobel Prize.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. No, he's done so much more than some guy that I found that they gave a Nobel Prize to back in 1902. It was a German who translated a bunch of coins from Rome to tell what the history of the Romans was. I mean, that was his whole thing that got him a Nobel Prize. Sitchin's gone way beyond that. And
absolutely.
So that's another, you know, avenue of my endeavor.
And how did you even come upon Sitchin in the first place? Just through your own research?
Yes. I was desperately trying to put together my question about Genesis, which is in the front of the book. And the other thing that really bugged me was that Moses came down the mountain with horns. And that story said, there's something screwy about that. And there's a page in my book, you'll see it towards the end, where I show where the horn thing came from. All of the Anunnaki leaders had helmets with horns on them. They were from the astrological sign of Taurus. That was their thing. So they all emblazoned their helmets. Even Ishtar has horns on her helmet.
Huh.
And so did Anu. And if you look at the cylinder seal, VA-243, you'll see Enki and Anlo self-portraits there with horns on their helmets. Well, they made a leader out of Moses. Took him up the mountain and, you know, gave him the words. And this whole thing about him coming down with horns was a sign of leadership to me. I mean, that's my story.
And so
that was the thing that drove me to find out how this all fit together, you know.
And then you read the Ascension books, and you just got in touch with him, and was he receptive to dialogue?
Oh, yes.
And he still stands by all the stuff he wrote and everything. And he continues further research.
He continues lectures. He just had a meeting in Chicago and in Florida, and he has a group of people that he gives lectures to. And then if you go to his webpage, www.sitchin.com, you'll see a bunch of articles on the left-hand side of that page which deals with everything that's happened, including the recent discovery of the planet that they call the 10th planet, which it really isn't. But
oh, yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, actually, too, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because obviously you're dealing in the realm of the 10th planet, and this is recently the news came out that they discovered a 10th planet, even though I think that news had come out years earlier, too.
Yes,
they keep discovering
1983.
Yeah, they keep discovering 10th planets. What do you think is going on there with that? Is that are they trying to discredit the whole the real 10th planet, which we know of as...
No, what's happened is that our scientific ability, Tim, has improved. You know, the two new telescopes, the Hubble and the Spencer, which is infrared satellite, infrared, is seeing much further. We're poking into the Oort belt now, which surrounds our sun, and there's a bunch of stuff in there that is hanging around that's coming out, and they're seeing it. But this is not new. This is just our science catching up with history. And my take on this is that I went back and researched the historical sightings of Nibiru. The Babylonians saw it, the Hebrews saw it, the Hindus, the Egyptians, and the Greeks. And they gave it different names. The Nibiru was what the Sumerians called it. The Babylonians called it Marduk. And the Hebrews called it the winged globe. Hindus, Tetra, Yuga. The Egyptians, the celestial disk. And the Greeks called it Nemesis. Now, the story of the problems that happened gravitationally, when that thing comes and passes between Jupiter and Mars every 3,600 years, you notice it. You record it. It does things, and, you know. And so we have a history of civilizations that have recorded its appearance. And then we also had the 1983 stories in the Washington Post and the New York Times, where they found it with their infrared astronomical satellite. So it's there. Discover Magazine cover story, November 2004, says the new solar system, and it shows Sedona, which is the one they found before they found the 10th. And then they call they have planet X, or the 10th planet, as big as Mars, and then beyond that they have planet Y halfway to Alpha Centauri. We're going to discover that our little system of nine planets is not really nine.
Yes, yeah. I might as well, I should probably ask you, because I've heard all kinds of kitchen skeptics and wannabe debunkers, and
yes,
I'm sure you've heard them. What's your take on that? And they usually assert that he's translating wrong.
Yes. Well, that's easy to do because the Sumerian language is made up of, you know, you can interpret some things five different ways. So it's easy to make that assertion. But none of them have done the scholarship that he's done. If you read his books, the bibliographies are huge and filled with the people that he's used. And he has taken, the one thing he's done is he understands the cosmology of what they were talking about. In other words, he's able to interpret what the translations mean because he's not blinded by preconceived ideas. And as far as those who you know, wish to defame him, you know, there are all kinds of people out there that saying, like, you know, we never landed on the moon. Stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I don't, it doesn't bother me. In other words, I personally, Tim, am fully satisfied that his work is magnificent, that he is on the track of what actually happened, and that my book was the proof of the things that he said, that I connected the dots. In other words, I took all of the factors that were involved that he's talked about, and I went and examined them, and I found other things about them that, for instance, did you know that the pyramid that has the snow-capped peak at Giza?
Do I know of it?
Well, you've seen it, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Did you ever ask yourself why those stones don't fall down?
Do I know of it?
Well, you've seen it, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Did you ever ask yourself why those stones don't fall down? Come on, give me a break.
And they just don't know how they can't make it, huh?
That's right. I mean, with all of our technology today, simple thing like a mortar, it's a glue, and they did it.
Hmm.
And in my book, I quote Petrie's take on that because he was a very, very famous Egyptian anthropologist and studied everything about it, and it's the thing that amazed him the most. It was like an optician working in the scale of acres.
Yeah.
Just to fit the stones. And then to put glue in the joints. So it's unimaginable.
I know, yeah. It sounds very hard.
Well, it's one of the things, you know, one of the many items that I refer to in my book that are proof that they were here, the Anunnaki were here, and that they left us this heritage of things that they did which had reasons to be done. Now, they had for their own reasons they did it, but they left us information. You know, the pyramid is filled with mathematical stuff.
Oh, yeah.
If you've done, you know, the studies on the circles and hypotenuse and Pythagoras and pi and phi and that stuff that was way before that was ever invented. And I believe that people will get a feeling from my book, Tim, that this is a story that's worth discussing with other people and looking at and getting the concept down, because I've kept it simple. I've made it kind of like Life magazine, and there's pictures and stories and evidence, and the evidence is overwhelming. When you put it all together, when you finish reading the book, you've got a wow.
And I would assume that would be your long-term goal for the book, was to make it an educational tool.
Fact, libraries are ordering it now. I'm getting orders from libraries that are in Saginaw, Michigan, and St. Louis County Library just ordered it.
Awesome. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, the word's getting around. So, and I'm dealing with some pretty important people in Kansas who are involved in this debate on the what to teach the kids in the classroom. And that's really what I want to get to. I want this to become not a textbook as such, but at least an item that gives them a choice. In other words, most school boards are opting out of the battle by saying, well, let's just present both sides and let the kids decide what they want to decide. Well, if they're going to present evolution and creationism, they've got to present genetic engineering. It's absolutely key.
Exactly, yeah. I mean,
And you're helping us, Tim. I mean, you know, you with your beautiful page and your stories of contacting the movers and shakers in the media world. In other words, you're part of the media world. And the media world is where we're going to get our power to get the story up.
Well, I do my part, you know.
Well, you do more than your part.
Well, thank you very much. I just want to thank you very much for giving me the time to speak with you and really...
Well, it's been my pleasure, Tim. I appreciate what you're doing, and I appreciate the chance to share the information with your audience.
And the book is Adam, The Missing Link, and the website is adamthemissinglink.com, and you can get the book through there. And Amazon, too, or no?
No, not yet.
Not yet.
No. All right. Just got our ISBN number, but we're still just at the webpage, www.adamthemissinglink.com.
And yeah,
there's three things. They can get an e-book download.
Yep.
They can get the hard copy, and they can also get a CD I made of the story of Gilgamesh, which is kind of an interesting item.
Nice. What do you read it?
No, actually, the CD plays like a movie.
Oh, okay.
It's like a CD-ROM. On your computer. It's a CD-ROM, and it has the story in an understandable version. I've made it so that people can understand, hopefully, why we got this story. You know, he's the first action hero. He's really quite a dude. Two-thirds Anunnaki. You know, his mother was an Anunnaki princess, and his father was a human. Which is kind of the other way around from the way it mostly happened.
And how old are you, Marshall? If you don't mind me asking.
Not at all.
Give me a rough number. What's that?
76.
You're 76?
Yes.
Wow, you're a pretty hip guy for a 76-year-old.
Well, I try to stay with it.
I'll say. Just from the phone call, if I didn't know you went to Caltech in the late 1940s, from it says in your bio, I probably would have guessed you were in your late 40s. So you were.
Thank you. I try to stay young in my head. That's the only thing you can do. Your body's going to age on you, but your brain will always stay active and young if you keep pushing it.
Exactly. Well, I think you've done a lot of great work for the whole ET progenitor theory, and I think your book's really going to help out a lot.
Well, thanks. I'd like to leave you with one quote from my favorite author.
Okay.
John Gardner. Life has many chapters. Learn all of your life.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you. The book is Adam, The Missing Link. The website, adamthemissinglink.com. Marshall Klarfeld, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Tim. Thank you.
That about does it this week for Been All of America Audio Season 1. I want to thank Marshall Klarfeld very much for taking the time to sit down and talk with us. I want to thank Leslie and Chiron of BeenAllOfAmerica.com for your continued support and work on the website. And all the great listeners out there in Been All of America Audio Land. If you're listening to this and you've been enjoying the download so far and you're into the podcast thing, I should point out that we have the podcast URL available at BeenAllOfAmerica.com. So check that out. And if you've found the audio and you want more Beenall, you can simply go to BeenAllOfAmerica.com. BeenAllOfAmerica.com. Thanks for tuning in this week. Next week, Terry Hansen, UFOs and the Media. This is going to be a knockdown, drag-out conversation. It is awesome. I had a blast talking with Terry Hansen. We covered all different aspects of UFOs and the Media, and I think it's a very important edition of Been All of America Audio Season 1, so you're going to want to check that out next week. Thanks for listening. This is Tim Beenall, signing off.